From WGCU, this is the Gulf Coast Life Book Club. I'm your host, Carrie Barber. This week on the Gulf Coast Life Book Club, we hear from Beth Macy, whose latest book is Paper Girl. Macy grew up poor in Urbana, Ohio. Through education, ambition, and support, she took on a professional career and moved to the middle class. When she was young, Macy remembers her hometown having great pride in being a stop on the Underground Railroad. More recently, Confederate flags were sprouting in people's yards. In Paper Girl, she returns to her hometown to investigate that swing. In doing so, she helps us understand the growing division all over the U.S. Beth Macy, welcome to the Gulf Coast Life Book Club.
Thanks, Carrie. It's great to be here.
It was so striking to me. So many things in your book were really striking to me. Let me just say that at the outset. It's such a moving book, and it really helped me to sort of put my finger on things that have been so awful lately in our country, and I kind of didn't know why. And your book helped to clarify it for me. But one of the things was your observation that we as a country have gone from having respect for higher education, thinking it's a way to move up and out in society, to basically having contempt for it. So I wonder if you can say a bit about that. And I know it connects to your own story.
Sure. It's a great question. When I went to college in 1982, as you said, I grew up pretty poor. I think my mom made $8,000 a year test driving cars. And that qualified me to get a full Pell Grant, which paid for my room and board, tuition. I got work-study jobs. I worked 3 work-study jobs most years so I could have pizza and beer money like everybody else. Mm-hmm. And going to college basically saved my life. I wouldn't have been able to go if it had been just loans, or if it had been what it is now, which is that the Pell Grant only covers roughly 30% of a poor kid's public 4-year tuition. And so what we've done over the last 40 years is we've basically taken the safety net of allowing a poor kid to go to college away without any discussion at all. We've gone as a country from number 1 in the world for college completion to number 13 behind China and Russia and other countries. You know, this started during the Reagan era, but it continued under Clinton. And we now have, you know, made it We've privatized higher ed to the tune of $1.25 trillion in individual student debt. So a lot of people, this thing has been, the flywheel of resentment about higher ed has been going on now for 40 years. And a lot of folks from places like Urbana have bought the notion that they wouldn't want to go anyway, that if I let my kid go to college, they'll just get, you know, woke and become liberal and won't come home again. And so I think that's part of the story, yeah.
You mentioned that Pell Grants cover such a small percentage now. Is that because, I mean, also college has gone up so much in price. Is it that they've gone down and the price has gone up, or both? Or
yeah, the Pells have gone up a little bit every year, but it's been in nowhere keeping with the price jumps in college. And part of the price jumps were like, you know, colleges competing to be on the best lists and that kind of stuff, and having sushi bars and all this kind of stuff that I never had, you know, would have dreamed of in the 80s. But also the state legislatures not supporting higher ed in such a way that the colleges had to increase their tuition. So it's a little bit of, you know, the fault of both.
And it seems like it's not just that, but it seems like in general, things are much harder. There's less support all around for kids who don't come from well-to-do families who want to get ahead, whether that's going to college or just getting any kind of training. Would you say that's true?
Yeah, like when I really looked into the number of kids in Urbana who go to High Point, which is the vocational school, there weren't enough slots for all the kids that apply. 3 kids apply for every 1 slot. I mean, we need to increase those slots, right? Mm-hmm. Especially when we have all these workplaces in towns like Urbana that can't get enough employees. So then they begin busing in immigrants, as I wrote in the book, from Springfield, Haitian immigrants from Springfield, at the same time, you know, the Republicans are lying and saying they're eating the pets and whatnot. But those Haitians were actually filling jobs that Americans weren't well enough or didn't want to take in those cases. So it's a really complex story with so many different, you know, variables.
Yes, it is. And that's why I loved your book, because I felt like you got to a lot of the variables. And I have so many questions for you. Now, it may seem like I'm jumping all over the place, but I just want to cover a lot of that waterfront that you covered in your book. Beyond the book, you are running for office, right? What are you running for, and how did you make that decision?
Well, I don't know if you remember, but at the end of the book, I sort of make this like manifesto, like, as Geraldine Brooks called the book, she said, is more than a memoir, it's a manifesto. I did sort of this call to action in response to something that the Ohio gun owners had posted that I had written about several pages before. But anyways, I basically say, and this is after the election when we're starting to see the DOGE cuts happen, you know, the last possible time I can change the book. And I'm saying we need to be reaching out to help these mutual aid groups that are being harmed by these cuts already. And we need to be running better people for office. And we need to be showing up at rallies. And so I started showing up at these rallies outside of our congressman's office starting last President's Day. So last February, we have been meeting outside his office. We haven't missed a week in 47 weeks. Now I've missed a few. I've been out of town, but they meet regardless. Sometimes it's 300 people, sometimes it's 80. And this call for me to run against Ben Klein, who won't meet with us, really grew out of these rallies. And I didn't want to do it. I'm a journalist. What do I know about running for office? I do know a lot about suffering people because this is what I've been reporting on my whole career. Mm-hmm. And they convinced me to do it. Of course, you know, it was a talk with my family and my husband. And he thought, I thought you were going to retire pretty soon. And I'm like, no, I'm not done. And in fact, I'm done writing about it. I want to do something about it. So I've launched this campaign. I'm not a politician. I'm proudly not a politician. But I've been reporting on the people left behind and listening to their stories my whole career.
Yes, and you're so steeped in it and well informed. Dare I say, better informed than many of the politicians. But you've been a journalist your whole career, as you said. You've been a Nieman Fellow. You've gotten a Guggenheim. You're like a very accomplished journalist, and I've been a fan of your work for many years, but I wonder, how does it feel to, you know, we as journalists are not supposed to advocate for anything. We're supposed to not have a bias when we're reporting. I'm just wondering, how does it feel to suddenly you're able to advocate now if you're running for office?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it was a little funny at first, even though I'd never been to a protest before. We're not allowed to do that as newspaper reporters. Mm-hmm. That's what I did most of my career. And I really didn't start publishing books until 11 years ago. Now, in the books, I'm in the books, which you're not supposed to do for newspapers either. But I feel like my books are so nuanced and they have so many people in them that I'm the thread that you follow, right? Mm-hmm. Not as much as in Paper Girl. It's a memoir, so I'm in there a bit more, but it's not a straight memoir either. It's very heavily reported. And so I'm not someone that ever grabs the speaker at the rallies. Like, I'm not that kind of person, but I go around, and what I've been doing, because we have almost no media compared to the old days, right, when we had reporters covering everything that happened, I've started writing these Substacks, reporting on what's happening. And a lot of times I'll just do interviews at the rally of, you know, talk to people about who do you know that's about to lose their Obamacare subsidies and things like that. So in some ways, a friend of mine said, you're the first political campaigner who's reported her own campaign. Mm-hmm. I am reporting the story as I go. And I'm reporting them on Substack. It's Beth Macy's Substack. I need a better title. If any of your listeners have any ideas for a better name. And because I think we don't, unless we find out what's happening, we don't know how to fight it, right? And so, like the Substack I had recently about the subsidies expiring, you have small business owners who are just being hammered by the, you know, many of them didn't even know they were getting a subsidy. Turns out 92.2% of folks who were on ACA in Virginia did get the subsidy. So suddenly their premiums, their healthcare premiums have quadrupled and they're just going without. I have a picture in my last Substack of a husband taking down the Christmas lights from the roof and his wife is screaming up to him, "Remember, we don't have insurance right now." Mm. And, you know, these are stories I can then use when I'm out in my listening sessions and on my campaign stops. And I think it just, the fact that I'm a listener and that I want you to know what's really going on, I think it, and I really care about these people. These are, this is my community. I've been in this town for almost 40 years. Like, I want that to come across.
Yeah. It's, as you mentioned, the media landscape has really changed. People are getting less local news. This is close to home because we're a local station here in Southwest Florida. And, you know, the newspapers are just folding left and right. And there aren't people at the county commission meetings and so forth, except for us. but what effect?
Thank you.
Yeah, I know. It's, I don't mean to sound like a hero, but I'm just to make my point that there's like, we're just being picked off one by one. And it's really, it's having a huge effect on the politics in this country, which is what I really wanted to ask you about. When communities don't have those local reporters, what is happening to the communities?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question. And it's something I don't think we think about. If you look back at the data of who voted for Trump in the last election, Trump in 2024 won 91% of the counties in America that lacked legitimate fact-check news.
Interesting.
I mean, that says it all. Folks are getting their information from social media, from right-wing media. We know that lies spread on social media 6 times faster than the truth, right? And so then you've got this algorithm going, and you're just being fed things that you already agree with, right? And that is so dangerous. We don't even know what we don't know, right? Mm-hmm. And you know, my editor didn't want me to offend people perhaps in the center or on the right by saying that people have been brainwashed. And yet, when I sat down with folks from my hometown and heard these crazy conspiracy theories from dear old friends, I mean, I was astonished. Mm-hmm. People who think children are routinely presenting themselves as cats at school and insisting on taking litter boxes. Or, you know, one friend, a former class reunion organizer, you know, believed Joe Biden was dead when he was president. That was when I was interviewing her. And that was an actor playing him with a face mask. And she, "I'll send you proof," you know. And I thought, wow, my conservative family isn't this right wing. I mean, it was the fact that it was so widespread, this idea that the 2020 election was stolen. I mean, I didn't really fully understand that until I embedded in my hometown how widespread that notion is.
Yes. That's another thing I loved about your book is that these were decades-long friendships that you had with people, and suddenly they were believing this crazy misinformation and disinformation that is being spread by certain networks and social media and so forth. And it really, yeah, it really hit home. And the other thing, you talked to an editor named David DeWitt, who said that when he reports anything that disagrees with Trump, he gets labeled left-leaning. And I have found that, too. I mean, we're an NPR station, so people automatically think we're like lefties, but we are honestly trying to report the truth. And yet in this environment, we get labeled as left-leaning. So how do you sort of negotiate that, or how do you deal with that?
Remember, my first friend in the world said, the lying media and the terrible New York Times. And I said, "Joy, when I write a piece for the New York Times, even if it's an opinion piece, that's mostly what I write." Mm. They put a young fact checker who went to Yale on it. I'm just making that up. But a lot of them, they're very well-educated people, you can tell. And let's say a piece I did maybe 3 pieces ago was a piece about an addiction harm reduction worker in rural North Carolina. And the piece, the opening of that piece was this nurse practitioner meeting a homeless, addicted person in a McDonald's parking lot to get him started on treatment. And it was just so cutting edge, right? Not what you expect in rural North Carolina. Mm-hmm. So I began the book, Raising Lazarus, with that scene. But then in the excerpt, I also began it with that scene. That fact checker at the New York Times tracked down the homeless person who was addicted, who didn't have the same phone number that he had when I interviewed him, and talked to him for one whole hour to confirm that what I said was accurate.
Wow.
And I told Joy that story. I said, Joy, it feels like your brain is at a colonoscopy. They work so hard to figure out even what your opinions that you're saying are based in real researched methodology and facts, and that you're not just presenting your version of someone else's story. And she got so angry, she said, well, who fact checks the fact checkers? Like, that is a level of distrust from her that I just couldn't imagine.
And it doesn't even make sense. It's either a fact or it's not. It's either true or it's not. You know, it's just...
Exactly. Exactly. But how do you combat that? And Joy also said one of the most profound things in the book, which is she asked me after I rolled my eyes, which you're not supposed to do, but I rolled my eyes when she said that thing about the children presenting as cats. And she said, yeah, but how do we love each other beyond what we can't understand or agree with? And I thought, that really is the question.
Mm-hmm.
But I do also think you have to be responsible for what you're saying. It's
right.
Not true. It's not true. And the media isn't bad people. It's people like you and me who believe what James Baldwin said, when we really are doing this as a public service. I mean, I didn't make much money when I was a newspaper reporter. My last 8 years, I didn't have a raise, you know?
Right.
Like, Silas the welder in my book is now making more than I was as a newspaper reporter with 25, 30 years of experience. But James Baldwin said, if you change how people see the world, even by a millimeter, then you change it. Hmm. And I think that's what, it's not that we're out to change the world. We're just out to help people understand it and maybe to connect people with each other. You know, I think that's really what the best journalists do. They help people understand what's going on around them and help them be better citizens. And then to be demonized on top of that when you're not making very much money and you're being called enemy of the people by the freaking president. I mean,
if you're just joining us, we are talking to Beth Macy, author of Paper Girl, a memoir of home and family in a fractured America. Well, speaking of what your friend Joyce said, do you have any, this might be too big of a question, but do you have any recommendations for how we can go about healing the division among people? Is there anything you're running for office. That's certainly a big thing someone can do. But are there other recommendations you have?
Well, I get the question, I was on book tour in the fall and Thanksgiving was coming up. And the first question is always, help, Thanksgiving's coming up and I'm supposed to go home and I don't want to, because all my relatives think differently than me, right? Mm. And I said, well, do go home. You don't have to spend the whole day, but do go home. And what I meant was, like, do try to still be family members. We have 1/5 of Americans are estranged from their families now because of this. And in my own case, you know, my brother and I hadn't spoken for a couple of years after he unfriended me on Facebook because of the op-eds I wrote and posted, which he called liberal crap.
Yeah.
And then, you know, I interviewed a lot of experts about how to conduct these interviews across the divide and how to just talk to my family across the divide. And they all said, don't talk about politics. Just go be who you are as human beings together, doing things that you once did as a family and that you're proud of. So I invited my brother to come to this little cabin we bought up in the mountains, right on a creek, because he's an expert fisherman. And our little cabin we bought maybe 2 years ago came with a bunch of fishing rods in it.
And I didn't remember how to fish, but that was something we always did. So Tim and I went out. He came up. He brought his wife. We had a great time. He brought me a tackle box, reminded me how to set up the fishing poles. I caught a bunch of fish, which I was like, I'm still teasing him about. I caught way more fish than he did. And then at the end of the day, we're having a beer on the deck. And he says, well, tell me about Sasha, who he's referring to my youngest child, who is non-binary and is a professional musician in a band. That Tim actually loves their music. And Tim said, does he still date girls? And I said, and he said it in such a nice tone. I think he would have said it judgmentally. I probably wouldn't have been able to do this because you get in your like lizard brain, right? When it's somebody, you think somebody's making fun of your kid or being mean to your kid. But I said, I've just mirrored back his curious tone. I said, well, yeah, they are dating a young woman now. And I mess up the pronouns too, which I do. Yeah, I just did it a second ago. And I try not to, but I do. But we got to extend grace to each other.
Yeah.
And so Tim and I are now in regular contact. Tim has driven 8 hours to see the band do an album release show in Virginia from his home in Ohio. He's a super fan on Facebook. And we've reconnected through music and through fishing and through food and, you know, and through stories about our mom, who was hilarious and feisty and difficult and all those things that people are. And we've learned how to extend each other grace. When politics comes up, sometimes he brings it up. I don't bring it up anymore. I don't take the bait. I just don't respond.
Yeah.
I mean, that's... I mean, a question I would, but otherwise I don't respond. And when I do start to get into a debate with somebody, the experts say we should listen, not just jump in with our memorized talking points. We should mirror back what they're trying to say with kind of positive intent. Like when Joy said that thing about cats, I could have said, I hear you saying that you're concerned about children and how they're being taught in schools. You know, that would have been a really nice version that maybe would have kept the conversation going a little longer rather than me, you know, rolling my eyes. It might have created a little crack of empathy. And the other thing, because I get this question a lot, I got a little cheat sheet here in front of me, but, you know, ask permission to weigh in when something like that comes up. You know, could I tell you what my experience has been? And then the last thing I'll say is just to try to put yourself in a vulnerable position, you know, whether it's, yeah, I mess up the pronouns too. That's a small example, but, I've struggled with that issue too. Or, yeah, that was a really hard time in my life and that was a hard decision. Or, you know, really just trying to get the person that you're maybe starting to get worked up about something they've said and trying to reestablish that we're just people here and relatives trying to move through life together.
That's really lovely. That's very helpful. I'm sorry to say that we are running out of time. Is there anything else that you would like to say about the book that we didn't get to?
I'll say one more thing if I can. I was really shocked at the decline in the public schools that had helped raise me. And I was shocked by the decline of support and the number of people who were taking their kids out in sort of paranoia to, quote, homeschool, some of whom were only doing it because they weren't sending their kids to school and didn't want truancy charges. And so just to see the level up, the graduation rate lowering, kids not going to school, and of course that really amped up during COVID, and then to see that the public citizenry, not the majority, but a growing contingent of them, don't even believe in the public school system anymore. I mean, I think that's a bright line for democracy's sake we don't want to cross. And so I think it's really important to elect local people that are going to, you know, support public schools and candidates, state legislatures that are not going to just deregulate homeschooling. I mean, some of these children need eyeballs on them.
Right.
They need eyeballs on them. And to just say you can do whatever you want with your kid, that's going to be disastrous for our nation.
Oh, I agree with you. Yeah, it's a lot to
lot to unpack, isn't
it? We've got a lot of work to do. Yes, but this book is so wonderful. Paper Girl, A Memoir of Home and Family in a Fractured America by Beth Macy. That's M-A-C-Y. And she has joined us today. Beth Macy, thank you so much for joining us on the Gulf Coast Life Book Club.
Thanks so much, Carrie. I really enjoyed it. And maybe next time we could do it in person in the winter.
Please buy the book from Macintosh Books through bookshop.org or order it from Books and Books in Miami. I'm your host, Carrie Barber. We had production help today from Mike Canary. This is WGCU-FM, Fort Myers 90.1, WMKO Marco Island 91.7 FM, NPR for Southwest Florida.